moment, a top advisor to Iraq's prime minister on the U.S. troop surge, Iran, and how Iraqis might learn to forgive each other. But first, in Paris today, the world's leading climate scientists released their most comprehensive and most pessimistic report yet, saying it is now very likely that by burning fossil fuels, humans are warming the planet, and that temperatures and sea levels will continue to rise for centuries. New York Times environmental reporter Andrew Rifkin has the latest. Andy, let's go to the language first. The last time this group met was in 2001. Then they said it was just likely that humans were warming the planet. Now they say very likely. So first, what's in this word very?
Well, they have kind of a quantified way of defining those words. Likely meant 66 to 90% probability. And very likely means 90 to 99% probability. So it's basically all but certain that humans are driving most of the recent warming. This is just since 1950 that they can make this case.
Right. They carefully calibrate this language. But still, some scientists we understand say the assessment's too conservative. There was a move to make the language, say, virtually certain.
Actually, that was overplayed in the media. That's actually not true, as far as I could tell. That doesn't stop some in the press from at least wishfully thinking that that was the case.
And us perhaps passing it along, but you're saying that most were in agreement with the language.
Yeah. And it's been a steady progression. The thing that's important to watch on these assessments, which have been, the first one was in 1990, is the trajectory, not the particular details about some negotiation over whether sea level is going to be 1.5 or 2 feet. It's the trajectory of understanding, and what we've learned, you know, I've been covering this now since 1988, is that humans are influencing the climate. It's heading the world in a pretty much almost unstoppable way toward warmer temperatures and higher seas for centuries to come. And what can be done with emissions policies is to cut the risks.
Well, in the past, some critics have complained that the U.S. delegation to these talks has been less than cooperative, maybe obstructionist. We understand, was there a shift this time?
Well, you know what? Actually, China was doing most of the obstructing this time, from what I heard late last night, and the U.S. was in the end more kind of willing to go along with things that they probably would have resisted a few years ago. In fact, the White House just put out a press release saying this was an important new blah blah.
Well, you mentioned China, and we want to get to that because talks were held in Paris, and this week French President Jacques Chirac demanded the U.S. sign both the Kyoto Climate Protocol and another agreement that would take effect when that accord runs out in 2012, I think, or face some sort of European-wide carbon tax. The U.S. says, well, wait a second, China hasn't signed Kyoto, and that's one of the things they hold up. So, first of all, you say that the U.S. might be, you know, in a shift. So what does that say to those threats that were thrown back and forth?
Well, yeah, Europe has there's a theory out there that this could become a trade issue, essentially. Countries that aren't adhering to the treaty could be docked a tariff by countries that are. And there's actually a precedent on this in the international courts related to shrimp, believe it or not. But at any rate, it's conceivable this could start to become a trade issue between parties that are acting on climate and those that they say are not.
Right. And Andrew Rifkin, one last thought. What did the group of scientists recommend? I mean, did they just leave it at that, or did they recommend things like lifestyle changes? What was the recommendation?
Well, this report is all laying out scenarios. In fact, in my story today, the scientist who led this, Susan Solomon, said, our job is to lay out the scenarios. They're kind of like in the Christmas Carol, they're the ghost of the future, telling you things that may happen, and it's up to you, society, to choose the policies. And they were very specific about not making that judgment for us. There's a report coming out later this spring from the same group on options for mitigation. But again, it's our choice. And the thing that's really profound here, what we're really talking about, is, as my piece lays out tonight too, is this is our children's climate we're working on right now, that we're shaping now, not so much ours. One thing that was in the report was fascinating was even you could pick the perfect policy right now and it wouldn't divert climate trends for 20 years. Hmm. So this is about our kids. And my book on this, The North Pole Was Here, is for the next generation, because we have so much work to do on this. It's
right.
Going to spill over.
Well, at least to those who want the work to start, this is perhaps good news. Andy Rifkin covers the environment for The New York Times and is, as he said, author of The North Pole Was Here, about scientists seeking answers to the puzzle of climate change at the top of the world. Andy, thanks for stopping in with us.
It's a pleasure.
Well, now to Iraq. The U.S. intelligence estimate on Iraq, released today, says that even if the violence in that country is diminished, the country faces a daunting task. Our next guest well knows that. Dr. Haider al-Abadi is top aide to Iraq's prime minister, and Dr. al-Abadi is in Boston to speak at Tufts University, and he came to our studios. He's here as the Bush administration is tying the surge of U.S. troops to benchmarks for success that the Iraqi government must meet, or some say bear the responsibility for failure. So we are thrilled to have an extended conversation with Dr. Haider. And we want to start with the U.S. plan. In December, you applauded the Iraq Study Group's recommendation that U.S. troops withdraw from your country. Well, now, as we said, instead President Bush is sending 21,000, maybe even more, new troops to the area. And further, they're going to live and work among Iraqis. So your thoughts, first of all, about this troop surge.
Well, we've always said strategically, we want a reduction in the U.S. force in Iraq. It's time for foreign troops to withdraw from Iraq.
In fact, Prime Minister al-Maliki, we understand, personally asked President Bush to at least have U.S. troops withdraw to the outskirts of Baghdad. You're nodding yes. Yeah,
exactly. Now, Prime Minister al-Maliki was asked specifically by President Bush whether he wants an increase in the U.S. forces, and the answer was no. But of course, President Bush came back and said that for peace in Baghdad, they need more forces. Now, of course, we've been left with no choice but to accept it. Now, if the U.S. Army is going to provide help to the Iraqi forces, and if they ask for more troops, you cannot stop them. Now, provided that, of course, is tactical. We have been told it's tactical increase. It's for short time, for just this operation, and they will leave later.
Well, it seems anecdotally, at least, that it is true. I mean, we're looking, for instance, at the recent fighting outside Najaf. Hundreds of perhaps members of a messianic cult, we're told by officials. And we're told that in that battle, Iraqi forces needed U.S. forces to back them up. So is there perhaps some truth to that, that still the Iraqi forces need the U.S. forces to help them?
Well, the main point is command and control. See, Iraqi forces need more training. They need more arms and more sophisticated arms, which they haven't been given that. And third, command and control. So far, the command and control exclusively in the hands of the U.S. Army, which is wrong. We must very quickly transfer this to the Iraqi Army. If the Iraqi Army, they don't have a command and control, they cannot wage a war against terrorists, against criminals, without outside help. Command and control is essential. Iraqi army cannot fly helicopters and fighter planes yet. So again, that's another question, command and control. They need all of that. That's why they needed the U.S. Army help, because they have to fly helicopters and fighter planes in.
So you're caught in a conflict. I mean, you and your prime minister want the U.S. forces to leave, but you recognize you need the U.S. forces to make your army capable of taking over.
Well, there is no conflict. Both sides, we want a secure Iraq, we want a prosperous Iraq, we want a strong government in Iraq, in order that Iraq will stay on this democratic path as it is at the moment. And this is, of course, is the same strategic interest of the U.S. In order to achieve that, you must transfer the responsibility to the Iraqis and giving them help, instead of keeping the responsibility in the hands of the American and asking Iraqis to perform. They cannot perform.
So are you and Prime Minister Maliki asking U.S. troops almost to get off the streets, but to at the same time continue to instruct the Iraqi forces so they can take over?
Yes. This is a transition period, which probably will take a year or so. And we're hoping, if this is agreed, by next year, U.S. forces can start to withdraw, and this is in the best interest of the U.S. and the best interest of Iraq.
But in the short term, we hear that the plan is that U.S. troops will, in fact, go more into the streets, get out of the green zones and the fortified bases, and be right on the streets with Iraqis working alongside Iraqi military. You've spoken in the past about your concerns about U.S. troops. They can't differentiate between friend and foe. They don't know the language. You're nodding yes. You know, what are they now that, you know, the plan is for them to be more on the street?
Well, this is for the security plan of Baghdad. Unfortunately, Baghdad was allowed to plunge into some sort of a civil war. People being evicted from their houses, people being killed, without any intervention from multinational force or the U.S. Army. Very minimal intervention. And we have to reverse that. If we don't reverse it very quickly, we will not be able to control the situation. So in order to reverse it, you have to put more troops on the ground and then let the Iraqi forces do the rest.
But you know that there are Sunnis who say they feel marginalized. They see that the prime minister is a Shia, that they feel it's a largely Shia government backed by the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi army. Can, for instance, your government arrest members of the Mahdi army? Will you be able to do that?
Perception counts in Iraq, everywhere. And there is a perception. There were people who were privileged under the previous regime. They've lost that privilege. They've lost that power. So they're wary and suspicious of anything that happens. But we are at least trying hard. We've managed to form a national unity government. Everybody is in it. We managed. We are working in the parliament. It is a working parliament. It's not perfect, but we work on things. So we have a lot of successes. We have a lot of failures. Over time, we are learning. But don't forget, this is a superpower who've tried for 4 years and was not very much successful with all the resources of the superpower. We don't have that resources. We've only been in office for less than a year. Mm-hmm. We must be given a chance. That's the only way out. Iraqis, we stay in Iraq. We're not going to cut and run. This is our country. We're going to stand for it until we are successful. This is not our last chance. If we fail, we'll learn from it and do it better. And next time we'll do it even better.
You don't think this is your last chance? Because some have said this, on the U.S. side at least, this is the last chance.
Of course, U.S. Army is there to do a job and go back home. We Iraqis, we are there to stay. This is our country. Yes, I can imagine probably the U.S. For the U.S., this is the last chance. For Iraqis, it's not the last chance. There was a lot of mess created in this country after the occupation, after the collapse of the regime. A handover of responsibility to the Iraqis and a fast withdrawal. That's the only way out of the current crisis. See, the problem is in Iraq, you have many army generals, many administrators from the U.S. side. They only stay for a few months and they leave. They're not there to stay. While Iraqis who are taking the responsibility, they have constituents there to answer to. They have an interest there in the country. So it's better to transfer everything, but we need a lot of help.
Dr. Haider, obviously you're here representing Iraq, but I wonder if you could speak on a personal level, because we understand, did you lose brothers to Saddam Hussein?
Yeah, two have been executed. We don't know yet how. We only discovered after the fall of the regime. We found papers. They've been executed. We don't know their graves, where they are, where they've been buried, whether they have been buried at all. One of my brother, third one, was imprisoned for 10 years. He lost his career. He was a second year medicine college, and he lost all his career. He's still there now. And the whole family was devastated. I mean, we've cut all contacts with the bigger family because people were even afraid to come to our houses because they'd be persecuted. You hear this story over and over again at many Iraqi families. It's a huge loss.
That's Dr. Haider al-Abadi. He's senior advisor to Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He's also head of the Dawa Party, and some say perhaps a future prime minister of Iraq himself. So, given what we just heard, how do Iraqis forgive each other? How does Dr. Haider do it? More with Dr. Haider al-Abadi after the break, here and now. With Dr. Haider al-Abadi, senior advisor to Iraq's prime minister. He's here in Boston to address a conference at Tufts University. And Dr. Haider, before the break, we were talking about your personal story. Two brothers killed by Saddam's regime, pretty much your family's life destroyed. Help us understand what has to happen in Iraq, because now some Shia families are seeking revenge. They say they only began committing violence after they felt attacked, after Saddam fell, but still, now everyone is fighting. So, how can Iraqis trust and forgive each other and move on? How do you do that?
See, the problem even was made more complicated, and that is another blunder. See, ex-Ba'athists were not arrested. They were let free, go free. Now, the point is, they haven't admitted their mistakes. How can you forgive such a people who committed so ugly crimes in the past? And now they didn't admit their crimes. They didn't apologize.
You're saying U.S. forces didn't do as much as they could do. I think it's pretty acknowledged that they couldn't. They didn't know what was going on. I mean, who could tell who was the aggrieved and who was you know, at fault. But you're having to deal with it on a daily basis. You're walking around a ministry trying to pull together a government. How do you do it?
I'll tell you. I mean, every day when I go out in the morning, I have, a number of bodyguards. I don't know whether this car next to me is a car bomb. It's going to explode.
And what are you thinking when you have to work with, because you've committed yourself to being a part of this government, so you have to work with a legislator? You're talking about, you know, maybe the insurgents in the street, but what about if you're face-to-face with somebody and you're thinking, this guy might have had something to do with the death of my family members, but what? I mean, how do you then...
I've been told there were ex-regime intelligence officers in my ministry. It was very hard. I mean, you well very know these intelligence officers. They have taken part in interrogation and torture. What do? You don't have evidence, of course. At the end, you decide you should go along with it. I mean, you keep it till the day when you can make them accountable, or you may never. I mean, a lot of crimes goes in this world unaccounted for. I mean,
which do you think is going to have to happen for Iraq? Do you think people like you who want to demonstrate leadership are going to have to forgive and move on? Or do you think there should be some sort of commission, some sort of truth commission, and some sort of public airing?
Yes, I think we need that. I think we have to reconcile at the end, regardless. But we need some truth. See, a lot of people in Iraq say, we want to know how it happened. We want to know who's done it. We want an apology. That's not forthcoming yet.
We're talking to Dr. Hadar al-Abadi, Senior Advisor to Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki in Iraq. Couple quick questions. Iran. You know the Bush administration has raised its rhetoric on Iran, accusing Iran of being behind the kidnapping and killing of U.S. soldiers recently, and saying that Iran may be training more splinter groups from area militias. Do you think that Iran is interfering in Iraq?
Well, I think Iran is interfering in Iraq. So is Turkey. So is Syria, so is Jordan, so is Saudi Arabia, so is the United States, so is United Kingdom, so is Israel possibly. So a lot of countries are intervening in the Iraqi affairs. But to what extent? What we are saying is this. I mean, look, the enmity between the U.S. and Iran is so deep. It goes back to since the Islamic Revolution. We cannot help that. We are not party to that. There's now a new question of Iran nuclear problem. We are not party to that. In actual fact, we're very much preoccupied with our own situation to worry about Iran nuclear question. We cannot influence U.S. policy on that, but at least we can ask, please keep us away from that. This is going to complicate our situation further. We are getting killed on a daily basis. Our infrastructure being destroyed. We want to build our country. We cannot build it without friendly neighboring countries. With Iran, we have the longest border. Most of our population centers are neighboring Iran, very close to the Iranian border. The relationship is interlinked. We cannot sever that. We cannot stop it. We can have more leverage on them if we have friendly relationship with them. Of course, that may run contrary to the U.S. interests. But we say, please keep us out of this.
And I just want to ask you briefly about the Iraqi economy. As you know, in addition to the surge in troops, there's a surge in interest in restoring the Iraqi economy, in reconstruction.
We've been told $14 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money has been spent in Iraq for reconstruction. While I'm chairing this committee, I tried to ask many people in the Iraqi government who has been there for 3-4 years, can you trace where this money has been spent? The answer is no. We cannot find where it's been spent, what is the utility being produced. We know there were a lot of projects which were incompleted, they've been left. They closed the book and they considered the project is done, but in actual fact it's not functioning. Mm.
Dr. Hyder, one last question. You would seem, as an exile for almost 27 years from Iraq, as someone whose family was killed by Saddam Hussein, family members killed by Saddam Hussein, you would seem to be one of the people who would most stand to benefit and be happiest with the U.S.-led coalition that toppled Saddam Hussein. But your country's in tatters. Do you think it was the right thing to do?
I have conflicting feelings inside me. the first feeling, yes, I'm glad the U.S. went and removed Saddam regime. I was glad. There was no hope under Saddam. The country was dying. No hope. Now, at least there is hope. We have a democratic regime, democratic process. We have a lot of potentials, and people know. They've installed their own system now. They voted.
But there's sectarian violence in the country's in civil war in parts, and it's torn apart.
We are facing this a huge challenge from elements of the previous regime. So I'm sad that the whole project failed because post-war was not thought of properly. I was amazed, to be honest with you, that a superpower like the U.S. would fail so drastically.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Haider al-Abadi is senior advisor to Iraq's prime minister and a member of Iraq's parliament. Well, next week on Here Now, we'll continue the conversation about Iran's role in Iraq with Anthony Shadid of the Washington Post. That's next week. But still ahead, how did a 29-year-old convicted sex offender enroll as a 12-year-old in several Arizona schools? We'll speak with a school official here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBEZ.
A disturbing story out of Arizona has schools around the country re-examining their policies for admitting new students. Police say a 29-year-old convicted sex offender managed to convince several school officials in Arizona that he was a 12-year-old boy. Neil Roderick, a 5'6" man who weighs about 120 pounds, reportedly shaved his body hair and used makeup to make himself look younger. He was living with three men at the time. Police say one of them was in on the scam, but the others, who initially met Roderick on the internet, believed he was a child and allegedly had a sexual relationship with him. All of the men are now facing charges, including fraud. Well, one of the schools Roderick attended for 4 months is the Imagine School in Surprise, Arizona, and now school officials are struggling to figure out how they could have been conned. The school's spokesperson, Rhonda Cagle, joins us now. Rhonda, we know you first learned that Roderick had posed as a child at area schools on the news. So what went through your mind when you heard that this was a 29-year-old man who you thought was a 12-year-old boy?
Well, obviously, like everyone else, we were shocked. We had a former teacher at the Imagine School contact our administrative staff and let them know that she thought we may have had this individual enrolled in our school. Our administrative staff went back to the school that night, combed through files, ascertained that indeed it did appear that that was the case. We then initiated contact with our local authorities the next morning and asked them to conduct an investigation.
You know that the next thought I'm sure people are thinking, administrators were thinking, was, how could this have happened?
Like every other school that unfortunately was part of this individual's scheme, we were given falsified documentation. And he went through the same enrollment process that any other student in a public school in the state of Arizona would go through. And in terms of physical appearance, there was nothing to distinguish him from any of our other middle school students.
Well, we're going to have Neil Roderick's picture on our website so people can see at here-now.org for themselves. He does look young, but people think that they would be able to tell. What would you say to them?
I can tell you that we had parents who walked by this individual every day. He stood out on our curb at pickup waiting for his ride like our other students. Parents drove by, walked by. Students sat next to him every day in class. We had teachers who obviously interacted with him every day in the classroom. There was no one who came forward during his time at our school with questions or concerns. He really did blend in.
And we're reminded that he did register at least four schools, including yours, so other schools were duped. But the Mingus Springs Charter School in Chino Valley wasn't, as you know. The school director said there was something wrong with the documents. What questions are officials at the Imagine School asking now in the wake of this?
I can tell you that as an added precaution, we had our attorney reviewed the documents, and we were asking ourselves the same thing. What did we miss? What wasn't seen? His opinion was a lay person who's not a legal expert doing routine examination of admissions documentation would have not had reason to suspect what we were presented with. our school is held to the same standards for admissions that any other school in our state is held to. That being the case, in this particular situation, the standards were not effective. So our school is saying, how can we exceed those standards? As part of that, we have asked our local law enforcement to review our admission procedures and offer suggestions as to how we can raise the bar, so to speak, in going above and beyond the standards that are currently in place.
I'm wondering if there's another loophole, potentially, in how he was expelled from your school for poor attendance. You know, some might say that should be an alarm for schools, and maybe there should be a safety net so that social workers or some other trained person is brought in before a kid is expelled if he's not coming to school.
Sure. In our particular situation, we had been led to believe that there was some sort of an ongoing custody battle, which was why the absences were taking place. This was a person with an intent to deceive, and we certainly were deceived.
Roderick apparently built a skateboard ramp. He made friends with kids at church. Authorities, as you know, found child pornography on his computer, video of him having sex with a boy. How were you making sure that no one at the school was abused? Because, it's, as we know, it's tough for kids to come forward with this. So how were you addressing that?
We initiated contact with our local authorities. We asked them to thoroughly investigate to make sure no child was harmed. In addition to that, we brought in certified counselors to be available not only to our students but to our families, so that anyone who had questions or concerns of a more personal nature, they would have somebody experienced and qualified to speak with about those concerns.
Now you forget about that. The kids know. So what are they saying?
Surprisingly, our students took it much better than the parents. Our students, especially those in our middle school program, had questions, but they were very factual. They were very matter-of-fact. To use some of the common verbiage that was used among our students, they said, well, that's kind of gross and creepy, but oh well, and they just sort of moved on. We're very grateful to know that at this point in the investigation, the detectives do not believe that there's been anything that has come to light that would give them concern that there was an appropriate contact between this individual and our students, and certainly that continues to be our hope.
Several parents did pull their kids out of the school. Some of them have returned. What are they saying to you?
Our parents faced a range of emotions. There was shock, there was denial, there was anger. But as parents have had an opportunity to process through this situation and to learn what the school has been doing, there's just been a lot of support, actually.
I'm just curious, have you heard from any other schools in any other parts of the country indicating to you that they fear they might have this problem?
We're not hearing from schools specifically in terms of having this problem. It's raising a whole spectrum of issues in terms of the threat has always been perceived as coming from an adult, a stranger. In this case, the situation occurred from one of our own, you know, somebody that you would not typically suspect.
Someone you thought was one of your own.
Exactly. And I think what we're hearing and beginning to hear is there's going to be a dialogue beginning to take place about what do we do about looking more closely at our students coming into the schools. We've had parents certainly asking, well, do we start fingerprinting our students? We certainly do it for all of our teachers and our teachers' aides. Do we do it for our students? If so, at what age? Where are the boundaries between civil rights and security within our schools and as it applies to our students?
Rhonda Cagle is a spokesperson for the Imagine School in Surprise, Arizona. Rhonda, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And this note, the Arizona Republic reports today that sheriff's deputies have been canvassing the neighborhood where Neil Roderick lived while he posed as a 12-year-old child. So far, officials have found no evidence that Roderick or the men he lived with abused children in that community, which is just outside Phoenix. Well, still to come, the music of the man with more than 400 film scores and soon one overdue Oscar. We'll hear the sounds of Ennio Morricone. You're listening to Here and Now. We have an update now on that marketing scheme mistaken for terrorism here in Boston. It was actually a promotion for the Cartoon Network's Aqua Teen Hunger Force, which features a milkshake, french fries, and a ball of meat known as Meat Wad, along with Moona Knights. And these are the figures that were on the signs that were mistaken for bombs. Here now is Monica Brady-Meyerhoff is in the studio. Monica, Turner Broadcasting, which owns the program, took out full-page ads in the local papers today apologizing, but are they going to pay?
Yes, they are. They've agreed to reimburse the city of Boston $750,000 that it cost them to respond to the hoax.
Okay, but other cities apparently had these signs and didn't panic. So critics are saying Boston overreacted. What are other cities saying?
Well, officials are saying in 6 of the 9 cities, these electronic devices were not found on bridges. So they didn't raise that much concern, and that's the difference. In Atlanta, they said, we didn't find any on a transportation areas, but if we had, we would have acted similarly. Seattle said, yeah, we found one on a rail trestle, but it didn't look threatening, so nobody raised an alarm.
Okay, different opinions. Well, meanwhile, the two young Boston men who were hired by Interference Marketing, that's a New York firm, to carry out this promotion, friends of the boys say that they were sent emails hours into the scare from Interference Marketing telling them not to tell anyone. Any sense of any further charges against, for instance, Interference Marketing?
The Attorney General of Massachusetts is investigating Turner Broadcasting and other groups. My guess is it's including Interference Marketing, but they won't confirm that. But Sean Stevens and Peter Burdowski, the two guys who were hired to put these things up, appeared to just not be too worried about other charges. When they came out on bail yesterday, they were really mocking the whole thing and refused to answer any serious questions and kept talking about haircuts in the 1970s.
We're taking this very seriously.
Yeah, please don't interrupt.
The 60s sort of had the mod hairstyle, which I believe evolved into the sort of greased back look of the 70s. But Peter, what you're saying is it maybe came more from the 20s?
Yeah, I really think it came from the 20s.
Well, we should say. One of them does have sort of a Beatles cut. The other has long dreadlocks.
They did apologize later, formally in an email, after that absurd press conference.
I think after they'd spoken to their lawyer. Monica Brady-Meyerhoff, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we have some time for some of your thoughts, and many of you wrote about this topic. Edward Onesimo of Milton, Massachusetts says, whether the post-9/11 hysteria in Boston was warranted, the hey, lighten up attitude of advocates of these marketing techniques fails to acknowledge that if Turner Broadcasting had gone through the established legal steps to permit their commercial advertisements on bridges, overpasses, and Fenway Park, they would have been summarily denied. Why should anyone be able to post advertisements free of charge on public property? Susan Baird of Hancock, New Hampshire agrees. Aren't there laws and fines that have to do with public property defacement? Did those guys have a plan to take those ads down? Go get 'em, Boston. Big business can't be allowed to act in such an irresponsible way. But Steve Kalman and others disagreed. He writes, I knew what they were from the start. I think the hard questions need to be put to Boston's Homeland Security and police departments. Why are they completely unaware of current urban artist tactics? And finally, from Roy Fuchs, rather than prosecute the so-called perpetrators, they ought to learn from them how easy it was to do this so a more malignant group doesn't replicate the stunt. Well, let's get a couple more of your thoughts on a different topic. After our segment on the book, The Show I'll Never Forget, many of you wrote about your most memorable concerts. Paul Simons from Levittown, PA says, the memory is being the only white kid in a bar in Cincinnati as Wes Montgomery leaned back having a ball with his band and the famous B3 organ. I feel bad for all the people who never got exposed to the earthy jazz and blues by the artists that invented it. And Joe Fountain of Trenton, New Jersey gave a call.
It would have to be the Kinks concert on their low-budget tour at Asbury Park Convention Center in the early 70s. They blew up the stage figuratively with smoke and lights on the first song, and everybody in the place was standing on their chairs for the rest of the concert. It was great.
Well, thank you, Joe, because how often do we get to play Lola by the Kinks live?
She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and in a dark brown voice she said, Lola, L-O-L-A. Lola, Lola, Lola.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call, as Joe did, at 617-358-0397. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now.
Like a woman, like a man.
Even if you don't know the film, the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know that music. It's the work of Ennio Morricone, the Italian composer who's written scores for well over 400 films, including a personal favorite, Cinema Paradiso, which won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film in 1989. Ennio Morricone will now receive an honorary Oscar of his own later this month. Oddly to many, he's been nominated 5 times, but never won. In fact, February is pretty much Ennio Morricone month. This weekend, he'll be conducting 200 performers in a special concert at Radio City Music Hall. And he's also the focus of both a series at New York's Film Forum and another series of films culled from the collection at the Museum of Modern Art. And joining us on the line from the NPR studios in New York City is Lawrence Kardish, the curator of that MoMA exhibit. Lawrence, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Reading a list of Morricone's work, just reading a list is enjoyable. It's like film history heaven. It includes also The Untouchables, Bugsy, Days of Heaven. How would you characterize his sound? Because you know it when you hear it. So what is it that we feel we know?
I think that one of the ways is the way the Academy describes it, and that's multifaceted and certainly versatile. His scores are, for the most part, extremely melodic. There's a deep harmony, and there's a character to the score that really is reflective of the film or the narrative or the tone of the film itself. He works very closely, or it seems to me, with the directors. And there are a number of directors with whom he works frequently. He did work with Sergio Leone, of course, and other directors like Brian De Palma and Bertolucci.
Well, let's talk about the work with Sergio Leone, a childhood friend of Morricone. We mentioned The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. There's also A Fistful of Dollars, Once Upon a Time in the West, which you're playing as part of your series. Why, by the way, did you pick that film?
It's a most memorable score, and it's a score that really elevates a film that is, well, it's never a traditional Western, but a very thoughtful epic into grand opera.
Well, let's move on to another sound and another film. This is the story of the 18th century missionaries in South America whose mission is eventually attacked by the Portuguese. This is Ennio Morricone's music for Roland Joffé's The Mission. You open your tribute series with it.
At the request of Morricone, he is particularly fond of that score because it is a combination of both orchestral and choral music. And the score really does have a particular life of its own, independent of the film, but it really also helps bring a sense of grace and transcendence to a somewhat violent movie.
Lawrence Kardish, you've also included in your series the film The Battle of Algiers. This tells the epic story of the guerrilla struggle against the French in Algeria. Now, this is a film that's gotten a lot of attention recently because many people are looking for parallels between this film and that war and what's going on in Iraq today. Apparently, it's being watched at the Pentagon. What does his music bring to it?
His music brings a certain propulsion and a dynamic element to the film. The film, don't forget, was also directed by a major Italian filmmaker, Pontecorvo, who died this past year. And it has become a textbook on how kind of insurgencies are formulated and how they operate and how they can be successful. And the attempts of the occupying forces, of course, to stifle it, and yet the will of the people will be expressed. And I think that the score reflects that, the will of the people overpowering weapons.
Other films in the series are Once Upon a Time in America, Two Mules for Sister Sarah, And then a choice, I was racking my brain to think, did I ever see this? Oliver Stone's U-Turn. Tell us about that movie.
Well, the movie is a rather quirky film noir. It uses all the conventions of film noir, the kind of hapless hero, the femme fatale, and double crosses upon double crosses. And it has a wit and humor about it, which the score captures. There's a kind of twangy sense to it.
I want to ask you about something we're reading about Mr. Morricone now that was unknown. I mean, if you just knew him from the film scores, you might think of the beauty, the lyrical nature of the music. Mm-hmm. But apparently he also belonged to a Roman collective that was a sort of part of an avant-garde movement, electronic music. And mm-hmm. this brought him to a whole new world of musicians in the 80s and then again in the 90s. Where do we hear that new music?
You get a sense of that in a film like Investigation of a Citizen Under Suspicion. Also, for some of the work that he did with Brian De Palma or John Carpenter, I'm thinking now of The Thing. I haven't seen The Thing for many, many, many years, but I do remember there were some modernistic elements in that score.
Morricone has influenced so many artists. And later this month, Sony is releasing the CD We All Love Ennio Morricone. It's a tribute album. It features artists as diverse as Yo-Yo Ma, Andrea Bocelli, Pink Floyd's Roger Waters, Metallica. Let's just listen to a second for Metallica's version of Morricone's The Ecstasy of Gold. Morricone, through Metallica's lens, what do you make of how he appeals to present-day rock and pop artists?
I think it's terrific. I think it shows his ability to speak to many generations because his work is so rich on so many levels that various artists can extract and amplify moments from Morricone scores.
Lawrence Kardish is a senior curator at the Department of Film at the Museum of Modern Art. The exhibit is simply called Ennio Morricone. And for more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Lawrence, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, there are about 350 left that we could play, but we can't leave without hearing a little of Ennio Morricone's Oscar-nominated score for Terrence Malick's 1978 film Days of Heaven. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time.